Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Alan Gerganis, author of Local Souls, and Rebecca Thieme, author of Hell and High Water, The Battle to Save the Daily New Orleans Times-Picayune. Gerganis is one of the most beloved of Southern writers, author of the bestseller The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, The Practical Heart, as well as White People and Plays Well with Others. He's back with his first collection in 10 years called Local Souls. It's rooted in a familiar North Carolina town called Falls, where the folks who live call themselves the Fallen. Alan Gerganis, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. Local Souls is such an appealing collection, and readers everywhere will recognize that devotion to place. So you even drew the map of the town on the end papers, right?
I did, yeah. I've been writing about this town since Oldest Living Confederate Widow, which was set there, and that was in 1989. And every time I write a story, it seems to be one street address up the road from the last house that I wrote about. And eventually, over 20, 30, 40 years, the town itself has become extremely real to me. So by designing the end papers to reflect at least 6 or 10 blocks of activity, I really made it real for myself, and I'm now drawing larger maps. I'm moving out into the countryside.
Oh, I love that. Well, there's such a range of characters in these stories. It's 3 novellas. I wonder if you tell us a little bit about the protagonists. They're all very different from one another.
They are, yeah. The first novella, Fear Not, begins with the terrible upset of a young girl getting pregnant out of wedlock and giving up her baby for adoption 30 years ago in the way that girls did then. Now kids keep their kids, you know. And it's one big happy family, but in my day, there was a tremendous amount of shame associated with it. So this girl gives up her baby. She doesn't even know his gender. And then 20 years later, through the internet, there's a re-encounter, which leads to all sorts of things. I've been fascinated by, you know, appearances and disappearances in fiction like Thomas Hardy's. And this volume is my attempt to implement that. The second novella called Saints Have Mothers is a similar kind of disappearing child story in a way. A very opinionated and intelligent but sort of self-destructive mother narrates the story of her 18-year-old daughter who's in Africa for a junior year abroad and disappears into Africa. And the results of that disappearance in the little town where the missing girl is lionized and the effect on the mother's life. And then the last decoy will be familiar to all New Orleanians because it's about that flood that comes once every 500 years and sort of takes whatever it wants. It takes everything. And that happens in the lives of a village doctor who is called Doc Roper, extremely revered and lusted after by everybody in town, and the guy who lives next door to him, who's fascinated by the good that Roper does and wants very much to have a friendship and more than a friendship that doesn't seem quite possible for two married men. But those are the basic outlines of each of them. Of course, there's much more meat on the bones than I'm allowed to say here.
Of course. And really, we're all local souls. I mean, we all belong somewhere, don't you think? Or at least we hope to?
Yeah, and more, as somebody who left North Carolina, where I was born, and then returned 21 years ago from Manhattan, I am catching up with myself, Susan. I'm really seeing how heroic are the lives of those that stayed. I was one of those that left, and I think I had the very good sense in my 40s that Manhattan, as for all its joys and adrenaline, is not a place to grow old, even if you have great wealth, which I don't. I just wanted an old house, and I just wanted to reacquaint myself with certain seasonal smells that you can't even identify. It's just the smell of mud at this time of day in this month, you know, that kind of detail. So I've really dedicated the book to those people who didn't go to Ivy League schools and who inherited the Budweiser dealership and just enough of a bribe to keep you in place and keep the lawn neat and, you know, see their kids through school and see their kids married off and live a kind of comfortable life that didn't seem to me very interesting when I was running from it. But now that I'm back in it, I have to recognize the heroism of so many lives. I can't think of a life that hasn't had a beautiful and noble struggle somewhere in it. It makes the novelist's job extremely easy in some ways because there's so much material. But I've tried to choose people who are both typical and extraordinary.
And you've also said that you don't really think a novelist gets going until he's about 40.
That's right. So, my gosh, I'm only 26. How about that?
I like it.
I'm feeling very frisky. You know,
well, good.
They always tell you that thing about 80 is the new 50 or something like that.
Right.
And you always laugh at it until you're 79, and then suddenly it starts making perfect sense.
Oh, yes. By then it's gospel. And of course, one of the things that is so endearing about these people is how much they worry about what people think of them. They worry that they'll turn out to be not the people think they are. And you have such a clear-eyed sense of who they are, but it's so sympathetic and it's so clear.
I'm so glad you feel that way, Susan. Yeah, I'm writing about people who are flawed because we all are. And who make no bones about that. They're wearing their faults right out there on the first page so that you get used to those the way we have to in any marriage or family. But I also wanted to honor their senses of humor because I think in talking about these stories in which dire things happen, which I think is what makes a story interesting, there is also this great expedient of humor. And to be funny, I think, is an extraordinary charm in the world. It's almost like having a religious nature. There are people who can make other people laugh, and it's almost like a great rare operatic voice. It's just some native endowment. Mm-hmm. And I've always loved humor. My mother was really almost Joan Rivers hilarious. And I miss her terribly. You know, she was just slashing, very funny. I always saw what an incredible defense it was to be able to make a joke about something, especially something that had just gone wrong. So I'm writing about funny people who are caretakers of other people. And I think that's a description of who I am. I think in a way we write novels and novellas to give ourselves people to take care of. And I think that's why novelists are, I think, about 99 percentile yellow dog Democrats, because we really do care about the health, education, and welfare of other people.
Absolutely.
And we have to feel that justice is possible, even in a world as corrupt and confusing as ours.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about these stories is that they're so full of disaster, and yet they, of course, are so funny.
Yeah, well, I think it's fun to hear people talk about their own family, you know, and they say things like, yeah, we're just a normal family, you know, just regular family. Of course, there is Uncle Ted, you know, with the shoplifting and everything. And his son is just completely off the map. And then the wife, they go on and on and on. And I think everybody, when they're telling their life story, says, Katrina, World Trade Center, you know, this is how we date our lives, around the disasters as well as the birth and the things that we rejoice in. And I'm very interested in emotion and how extraordinarily unexpected emotions almost always are. It may be the one constant is, you know, you're confused. You cry at weddings and giggle at funerals. It's never quite where you think it is. And so I have this in part from writers that I love, like Flannery O'Connor, who was always setting a tractor on fire or having a car fall on somebody's foot or something
right.
like that. I thought, now that's interesting to me. It's perfectly great to register somebody making coffee and breakfast in real time. But I want, when I go to the opera, when I go to the theater, I want something to happen. And it's a joy as an artist to be able to invent things that are not destructive in the sense that they annihilate the character, but they totally test the character and therefore let you know the character in a much more complete way than if you simply accept their placid social good manners exterior.
Well, one of the great terms from voodoo, I think, is that word ashe, the power to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, novelists have to use it responsibly in every way, I think.
Absolutely.
Well, I know you have a new editor and a new publisher, and I know you have the next two books in mind. You sort of promised them to readers.
I have, yeah. I write constantly. You know, 6 o'clock in the morning, that's what I do and what I want to do every day. But publishing is a completely different enterprise. But I've sort of accumulated behind my back, as it were, 3 books, Local Souls, which is just released. And the next book will be called My Heart is a Snake Farm.
Ah.
20 stories, and it's 20 stories that have never been collected that I'm writing even as we speak. And then the next book is a kind of companion piece to Oldest Living Confederate Widow, and it's called The Erotic History of a Southern Baptist Church.
That title makes me so happy. I can hardly stand it.
Imagine the fun of the research I've been doing. I can't tell you.
I cannot wait. I wish you would hurry up.
I read that Sinclair Lewis, when he was writing Elmer Gantry, went to 3 evangelical church services a day at different parts of town. So I feel like I've got my license cut out for me, and it's really it's been a lot of fun so far.
Now, you're also at a time when you're seeing a lot of your students achieve phenomenal success. I mean, you've taught, I'm thinking of Ann Patchett and Kate Christensen and such rising stars as Justin Torres and Ayanna Mathis, and it must be really satisfying for you to see them reach such heights.
Oh, it's fantastic, Susan. It's really like, I don't have any biological children of my own, but this is sort of like the books they're giving me are grandchildren. That's the equivalent of a grandchild, where you've helped raise up somebody, and then there's this pure bonus, which is their production, something out of their bodies, that they give to you and mention you in their books. Ayanna Mathis's book, you know, she thanks me in the back of it. And Justin Torres, and, you know, Anne has been extremely dear and loyal.
Oh, yes.
I can't even describe the happiness of seeing really good work. Of course, every teacher wants the students to go forth and multiply. I would be happy if they published a book, but they're really writing good, good, good books. And I can honestly point to what I think are the leading talents of the generation and say that I had a little part in their path to recognition.
Well, you're a really good teacher.
Thanks.
I love it when you describe a real writer's friendship as kind of not knowing the difference between your writing and theirs.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, that's real marital concord, isn't it?
We've been talking with Alan Gurganis, the very generous novelist, whose wonderful new book is Local Souls. You can meet him Wednesday, October 16th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Don't miss it. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you, Susan. This has been so much fun.
Rebecca Thieme lives in Las Vegas, where she is a corporate and public relations writer. But before that, in a former life, she lived in New Orleans and worked for the Times-Picayune. So last year, when change began to rumble through that venerable newsroom, Rebecca paid attention. And when the 3-day-a-week publication schedule was announced and layoffs followed, she began to think of ways to save her former employer, as well as ways to help her former colleagues. She founded a 501c3 organization called Dash 30 Dash, after the Standard Newsroom sign-off, and held a fundraiser for unemployed journalists who needed a little help getting by. All that work, all that passion, has resulted in a new book, Hell and High Water, The Battle to Save the Daily New Orleans Times-Picayune. We're speaking to Rebecca from the studios of KNPR. Rebecca Thieme, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's so great to be there with you virtually, and I'll be there in just a few days in real person time.
Exactly. Now, full disclosure here, as a former employee of the Times-Picayune myself for more than 20 years, I found this book very painful to read, as I imagine many journalists will, and I'm sure it was very painful to write.
It was. I became deeply involved in this because it mirrored some things that had happened in my own life. I had been the victim of downsizing, and I knew what that could mean at this time of life, particularly for the folks who were still there, who I had worked with when I left the paper almost 20 years ago now. And I really felt the need to try to reach out and let them know it wasn't them, and also to do something to help commemorate this amazing, heroic, then 175-year-old newspaper that so many people in that community depend so deeply on.
Well, it's rare in life that you live through a moment that you know is changing an entire industry. And I think a lot of people felt that when that report in the New York Times went online about cutting back to 3 days a week. So what was your first involvement with these efforts to save the paper and to start Dash 30 Dash?
Well, I had been in touch with a handful of folks I had worked with through the years, and I'd seen people periodically when I was back in New Orleans or when they were visiting in places that I lived over the years. But I really, you know, I felt a reconnection to New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina and seeing what that city went through and what our government allowed to happen there. And I had been more attuned to things that were going on there since. And social media certainly helped me be back in touch. And so I had been in touch with some people who had been concerned ever since Ashton Phelps Jr., the longtime publisher, had announced his retirement. And I got the alert as soon as David Card, the New York Times media writer who broke this story and wrote so many great stories and continues to cover the issue quite closely. And I immediately started emailing folks in New Orleans who I knew, trying to find out what was going on. And another Times-Picayune alum who's now at UCLA in the communications department there started the Friends of the Times-Picayune Facebook page the next day. And it just sort of snowballed from there.
Now, you know, this is a change in an entire industry, but you also treat it in that way, and you also treat it in great detail as the demise of a local institution, of an institutional collapse. And this is a local example of a national trend, but some things made it very, very different here.
Well, in kind of telling the parallel story, I thought it was very important, and I wanted to document what had happened there and put real faces and real lives in the context of what was happening, specifically in this industry, but also generally as these layoffs had been just devastating during the country's Great Recession. So I really wanted to put a face on that, and that's obviously one of the great tools we learn when we're journalists. So that was very important to me to tell that part of the story. At the same time, as you've already mentioned, the newspaper industry has been in a free fall for about a decade now. And that was important, I think, to put the story in the context of what Advance Publications, the corporate owner of the Times-Picayune and about 2 dozen other daily newspapers across the country, what they might have been thinking and what they were facing from a business perspective as they tried to figure out what to do to ensure that these businesses would continue profitably. So those happened parallel. To the point of what was different in New Orleans and perhaps why, I think the book certainly strongly suggests, and several people both inside and outside the newspaper since have suggested, that a lot had to do with Katrina. And the way the newspaper covered both the event and the way so many of the employees put their own well-being on the line and were out there reporting and putting the newspaper out and editing the newspaper, even as their own homes were destroyed. Just the amazing amount of personal sacrifice and heroism had really bonded that newspaper to that community in a way that I don't think you see in any other U.S. city. I could be corrected on that, but that's my impression. So when this institution, again, at the time, 175 years old, in the middle of celebrating this momentous anniversary, when the news did come down, the community reacted in a way that I don't think anyone could have foreseen.
And you do talk a lot about some of the specific individuals and some of the terrible dilemmas they faced after being laid off. I wonder if you'd talk about a few of those folks for us.
Well, I guess one of the kind of major protagonists of the book is a fabulous reporter, has been an editor with the paper, and is, I think, widely regarded as the newspaper's best writer, and that's Bruce Nolan. Bruce was my boss for 5 of the 6 years I was at the paper. And he, I think, underwent an amazing transformation. he'd gone from someone who had a 41-year career with the newspaper, was deeply loyal to the institution, had, in fact, on occasion written speeches for Ashton Phelps Jr., the publisher. And as this happened, he just sort of stepped forward, and he actually delivered a pretty forceful, but again, in Bruce's style, amazingly graceful and articulate rebuke of whoever was behind this during the staff meeting in which it was discussed following the New York Times initial story. And that rebuke was surreptitiously recorded and later provided to the New York Times, which put it on its website. So suddenly this became fodder for anyone who had an interest in this issue. And while I think he was probably embarrassed that it got out there, I had a long conversation with him for the book afterward, and he was saying he was very proud to stand by it and that he was in the position to be the person who told them that people who had done what this staff had done post-Katrina deserved to be treated better than this. So he's a real hero of the book. You know, John McCusker was a veteran Times-Picayune photographer who had tremendous personal loss in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. He's also definitely somebody who gets some pages in the book. There are so many people who talk to me behind the scenes, fearful of their job or fearful of retribution if they did speak to me. One staffer in particular had an incredible file of many of the pivotal company internal correspondence, not anything proprietary, but things that the company had issued to the employees over the years that helped me document the cutbacks and the things the staff had faced in the years since I had left the paper. So I owe so many people that I can't name a debt of gratitude for helping me shape the story.
Well, it's so interesting to me that in the book you also cover the story of Alabama newspapers, and that's where you're from. So it must have felt like, you know, your whole past life.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama. I left there when I graduated high school, and I've not spent any extensive time back there. And my family has since moved. So I don't spend time back there now. And of course, when I was growing up and even in high school, didn't understand kind of the dynamics of corporate ownership and the fact that the Newhouse family, Advance Publications, also owned the newspaper there. But yeah, it's a little bit of a blast from the past, but I did think it was very important, although I cover it not nearly as in depth in the book as I do New Orleans. I really felt it was important to at least document some of the things that also went on with the three newspapers in Alabama, the Huntsville Times, the Birmingham News, and the Mobile Press Register, because that market just got so much less attention than New Orleans did in the aftermath. And they don't have, so far at least, a billionaire businessman like John Georges who stepped forward and bought a newspaper and is now trying to reinstate competition. And they have not had nearly the flood of the fabulous niche websites that New Orleans has had to sort of fill some of the vacuum that was created when all this went down.
Well, one of the fascinating things about this book is that it describes the way a group of the city's best journalists ended up playing musical chairs, moving to different newspapers, different kinds of outlets, and now we've ended up with this newspaper war.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that at a time when there's declining newspaper readership and papers continuing to fold and more markets that only have one newspaper, in fact, the vast majority of them only do have one newspaper these days, that we're seeing this old-fashioned newspaper war unfold in New Orleans.
Well, it is a fascinating book. We've been talking with Rebecca Thiem, author of Hell and High Water, The Battle to Save the Daily New Orleans Times-Picayune. You can meet Rebecca Thursday, October 17th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books, or again Friday, October 18th from 5 to 7 at Rock and Bowl, 3000 South Carrollton. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thanks so much, Susan. I really enjoyed it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Catherine Brosman signs Louisiana Creole Literature, a Historical Study, Tuesday, October 15th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The Fiat Lux Book Club, which considers Catholic books and writers, discusses Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh, Tuesday, October 15th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The editors and authors of a new steampunk anthology featuring stories set in New Orleans, titled New Orleans by Gaslight, will hold a book launch party Tuesday, October 15th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Yucca Pets presents a basic beginner's bookbinding Workshop, Tuesdays, October 15th through November 5th, at the Jewish Community Center from 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. To register, call Meryl Rosenblum at 504-897-0143 or email meryl@nojcc.org. Today's guest, Alan Gurganis, reads from Inside's Local Souls, Tuesday, October 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. And October is National Reading Group Month for all you book lovers out there. That month is sponsored by the Women's National Book Association. The New Orleans chapter will hold a book and CD sale, along with a panel of mystery writers, Pamela Bennings-Ewan, Jean Redman, and Erica Spindler, moderated by Antoinette D'Alteris. That's Wednesday, October 16th at 7 at the Newcomb College Center for Research on Women. Don Paul's Poetry Ball features Moira Crone, Roger Kamenetz, Melinda Palacio, and Shedrick White, reading their work Wednesday, October 16th at 7:30 at Cafe Istanbul. Today's guest, Rebecca Thieme, discusses Inside's Hell and High Water, The Battle to Save the Daily New Orleans Times-Picayune, Thursday, October 17th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Friday, October 18th from 5 to 7 at Rockin' Bowl, 3000 South Carrollton. Deborah Burr signs Hallowed Halls of Greater New Orleans, Thursday, October 17th from 5:30 to 7:30 at Degas House, 2306 Esplanade. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their semi-annual big book sale October 17th through 20th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, the 17th through 19th, from 10 to 8, and Sunday the 20th from noon to 5. Free admission. For more information, call the Friends of the Library at 504-455-2665. Proceeds benefit the Jefferson Parish Libraries. Poet Zach Rogow reads his work Thursday, October 17th at 8 at the Goldmine Saloon. Novelist Eric Flint, author of the 6-volume Belisarius series, will be the author guest of honor at the 3rd Annual Contraflow Convention, October 18th through 20th at the Doubletree by Hilton New Orleans Airport in Kenner. The weekend includes film screenings, parties, a dealer exhibit, and panels on everything from the secrets of Freemasonry to the legends of New Orleans to how to craft believable dialogue. By admission. For more information, check out contraflowscifi.org. Carolyn Cobb signs New Orleans Memories, One Writer's City, Friday, October 18th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Dean Pascal reads from and signs The Frog Surgeon, Friday, October 18th at 7, at McEwen's Books and Difficult Music. Barrett House, Metrichik, and Jefferson Parish Parents host a local children's book festival Saturday, October 19th from 10 to 2 at Lakeside Mall. Just in time for Halloween, SOLA, the South Louisiana chapter of the Romance Writers of America, presents Scott Banville of Nickel State, explaining everything you want to know about Dracula but didn't know to ask, Saturday, October 19th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsin Hamid, Saturday, October 19th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Tom Zickel signs his novel Many Rivers to Cross, Sunday, October 20th at 1 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Hope to see some of you when I visit Our Lady of Holy Cross College Library to talk about my revised Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans, Sunday, October 20th at 2 p.m. Poet Gina Ferrara reads from her new collection, Amber Porch Light, appearing with songwriter Les Kerr, Sunday, October 20th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.